That's the Dave Matthews Band in the background there with, of course, Ants Marching. Welcome. You're listening to KHNS Haines Skagway and Klukwan. My name is Angie Pappas. It's time for Art Matters. This is a show that highlights the arts in the Upper Lynn Canal, and I've got my guests with me here today. Rhonda Degtoff, who is a weaver, and Zach James, who is a carver. And we're going to talk about the art forms themselves, about how they work, about their tools, about what they're doing. And let's see. Just introduce yourselves and say hi.
Hi. My name's Rhonda Degtoff, and I am learning to be a cedar weaver this year with my mentor, Deborah Head, who lives in Craig.
All right, and Zach?
My name is Zach James. I've been kind of working on and off as a carver since 2009, and I've studied kind of over the years most of the different Tlingit art forms.
All right, who would like to start?
I'll start.
Okay. All right. So tell us about anything you'd like to tell us about what you do, the tools that you're working with, the work that you're producing, the master that you're working with, and how you get your materials, because I think that's the really interesting part.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cedar weaving, and we don't have cedar trees up here. So my mentor lives in Craig, and I've been getting my cedar from her. I took a trip back in the first part of February down to Craig to learn from her, and she showed me all the tools and techniques and the cedar that she has, and started teaching me the Tlingit weave. A year and a half ago, I took her workshop and learned the Haida weave and weaved a tiny basket. The tools I use, it's pretty much just my hands. I do have a little crafting knife that I use to thin the materials down, the weavers, and to thin the cedar down. Let's see. I am currently making tiny basket earrings. And my project for the year from the apprenticeship is doing a cedar hat. I see my mentor this weekend, actually, in Juneau. We're both doing a workshop with Sea Alaska Heritage for the next 2 weekends and gathering spruce, so I can start learning the spruce as well.
Okay. All right. Can you tell us about where you get your materials for weaving?
Well, the main material is the cedar itself, which I get from my mentor, because we don't have any cedar trees up here. The other materials is just pretty much just scissors and a crafting knife that I use to thin out my warps and weavers. I don't need much materials to make the stuff that I'm making. It's pretty much my hands.
Does the cedar that you use grow in pretty specific places?
Yeah, southern part.
Okay.
Southern part of southeast. Yeah, because we don't have no cedar trees up here. Eventually, I'll be learning the spruce as well, mm-hmm. which we do have that in abundance.
I know that with the spruce, the roots have to be very straight, so I think sandy soil is best. Is there something like that for the cedar where there are specific locations that it should be growing in?
I have not learned much on that yet. I will start learning on the spruce this weekend and next weekend in Juneau with my mentor.
Okay.
But I'm real excited to learn every aspect, from beginning. beginning to end of the product. And every single step is very important in making a good quality product.
Yeah, you do a lot of preparation, I'm assuming.
Most of it's preparation.
Yeah. Can you tell us about that?
Well, with the cedar, it starts out with a bark. And I have a jerry stripper that I use that I pull the bark through. And that's how you get the uniform, you know, correct size. Mm-hmm. And then every warp and weaver, I use my crafting knife to pull apart the pieces and get to the correct size that I want to weave. So every single step from getting it off the tree to the end is like so important that I've learned so far. The correct width and, you know, it has to be very consistent through the whole product because it will, you will notice when the product's done. So far I've learned two weaves from my mentor a year ago was the Haida weave, which I enjoy doing a lot. It's really easy to me. Right now I'm learning to clink it. Just a little bit more difficult for me. But yeah, I'm enjoying, I'm soaking up everything that she throws at me.
And folks, I know you can't see it through the radio, but Rhonda showed me these tiny little baskets that she made as earrings. And there are these absolutely perfect little miniature woven baskets. It looked like she took baskets and put them in the shrinkifier and turned them into little earrings.
Yeah, I actually use a pencil tip as my form to make those.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Zach, want to talk a bit about your carving?
Yeah, so the project I'm doing right now as part of the Master Apprentice program is a 10-foot house post, and it's made out of red cedar. It's about 4 feet wide at the base. That was when it still had a lot of the sapwood on. I think it's probably more like 3 foot, 10 inches now or something, but 4 feet at the base and 10 feet long. What should I talk about? So in old pictures of Klukwan or here, you don't see a lot of totem poles out in front of the houses. That wasn't something that was done very much here. And why, I couldn't tell you. I could guess. We have much harsher winters than places down south. And not only that, but, you know, red cedar doesn't grow here. Recently, they've introduced some yellow cedar just as kind of like a study. A couple lawn ornaments, and then I believe after they did some logging here, they planted like an experimental forest of yellow cedar, and it does all right. This is considered like the north of its range, but no cedar here really to speak of, and so if they would have used an alternate wood like spruce, it wouldn't have lasted very long outside. So most of the large kind of sculptural forms that were here were house posts inside the houses. Means it was more protected. That's not to say that there wasn't quite a bit of sculpture happening here. It was just in different forms rather than totem poles. I can think of quite a few different, like almost monumental scale masks. I think of the woodworm girl. I think there's a different picture too of a different real big one that is kind of a call it classic amongst people. Kind of looks a little bit like a bear, I guess, but a little more like a human. So there's quite a bit of sculpture. A couple great pieces. I can think of quite a few, like the Kushika transforming mask. Skunda Ooze collection of things as well. And those ended up all over the country. I think one of them's in Florida. UPenn, New York. But so, you know, there was a tradition of sculpture here, regardless if there was any large totem poles outside. But yeah.
All right. Can you tell us a bit about your own carving?
Yeah. So what I wanted to do, it's not a traditional piece per se, especially since it's a house post, you know, that would have been more of a something commissioned, like it's uwu, you know. It would have been someone from the other side of the moiety asked me to make something for them to tell a story, their story. And so, yeah, it's the, in your career as an artist, as a traditional Tlingit artist, you're mainly trying to meet the needs of other people rather than your own personal interpretations. But if you look at year to year, especially a long time ago, if someone recommissioned the same piece, it would look pretty different. So the story is up to the other side, but the artist has a lot of free rein in what they, how they display it, how they show it, the sculptural forms they use, the shapes. So getting back to what I'm doing, I wanted to make something to, kind of honor my grandfather, and he's Shungu Katy. So I would just make real simple, two figure post. It's going to have a big head at the bottom, and sitting on top of the guy's head, there should be a thunderbird. And it kind of should look, it's going to look like, kind of like the thunderbird is like a big hat, or maybe even a shuckiat kind of on his head. So pretty simple, you know.
All right, and how long do you think this piece will take you?
I'm supposed to finish it in October.
Okay.
Hopefully that happens. But been working on it since last year. This is second year. Mm-hmm. A lot of that time, too, was trying to find and then make a place where I could carve it. Couldn't bring it in the house. I'm sure the thing weighs over 1,000 mm-hmm. pounds. Yeah, it shouldn't take too much, hopefully too much longer. Most of the big sculptural forms are roughed out right now. You can see the nose and the indentations for the eye socket and all that kind of stuff. Lips will go on fast. you know, surprisingly, stuff like carving a nose and carving an eye, it's pretty straightforward, you know. It's just a sphere with, eyelids slapped onto it, really. There's nothing to an eye. It's the simplest thing in the world, but the complex part is really the rough kind of the big forms where your nose, the relation of all the features of the face, the relation to the nose, to the eyes, nose to the chin, where the lips are positioned in between the nose and the chin. All those things are surprisingly the hard part, which are kind of decided very early on. So I feel like I've nailed it down where everything needs to go. I made a small adjustment and moved the eyes up a little bit so I could make them bigger. Hopefully there'll be some form line in the eyes. But it should go surprisingly fast. And then the bird should be easy. It's you know, two wings and a big head. Now, there's a lot of different kind of finesse you can put in the kind of the stylization of the bird head, especially if the beak is an add-on piece or the beak's not an add-on piece. the form line, two-dimensional art, seems to be very rigid and structured. You could say that there's hard and fast rules for how things fit together, and then sizes in relation to various things. And it's all based off of golden ratio Fibonacci sequence. And there's been a book published all about kind of sacred geometry and Thlinkit art, but carving's a little different. There's a lot more individual choice with how things are done in individual features. But I say that, but the head, the bird should go a lot easier than the head. There's just so much kind of feeling and emotion in the human face. You move the corners of the mouth, you know, half of an inch, and you can turn pleasant contentment into contempt, you know. So it's always a really careful and sensitive kind of placement of things when you have a human head on there. But yeah, anyway.
No, that's the interesting part, is how you handle things like that. And each, as you were saying, you know, I think the iconography is pretty much established, but if I'm not wrong, but it's the artist who has more leeway in how they interpret it.
I think so. I can recall the CCC totem poles they mm-hmm. did for the Conservation Corps right. back in the New Deal. The How Can Eagle was a perfect case study for Trey, that kind of thing. They commissioned this guy who was, you know, in his 70s. Mm-hmm. He and this was in, what, the 30s?
It would have been the 30s, yeah.
It would have been the 30s. So he was alive and carving in the 1800s, you know, so you could legitimately say that he was born in and participated in the culture. They asked him to copy this totem called the How Can Eagle. And it was, you could see in the writing that it was going to be this big project, like his statement piece, that he was going to put all of his time and his effort in there. The original How Can Eagle has some kind of layered feathers on the chest. And some people say that's kind of indicative of like the Russian Imperial Eagle. You see a lot of those kind of. Anyway, when he did his duplication, instead of feathers, you know, he made it all form line on the inside of the wings and on the chest of the bird. And the Park Service was livid. They sent an extra man to watch him. They made him carve it again as an exact duplicate of the original. But so in his mind, a recarving of that How Can Eagle, you know, true to it, didn't have to be an exact one-to-one replica or duplicate. There's a lot of it was accepted that there would be some artistic license and interpretation from the artist. And I think I'm going out on a limb here, but I think as generations go by, you know, we carry these stories forward, but the presentation of it changes. The culture slowly evolves over time, even though the important story remains, you know. I always hear that a lot. I think I heard one story one time. People sat around and asked themselves the question, what stories did young people today need to hear in order to survive in the world we live in now? And this isn't, this wasn't a post-Western contact kind of conversation. This was just something that was continuously being revised, continuously being examined. Things were being re-examined all the time, you know. So
this was just organically part of a culture where storytelling is how information is disseminated. Would that be right?
Yeah. That's not to say, I mean, there's a real emphasis on telling a story correctly, you know. But I think in terms of art, it was understood that free license by the artist was important.
Which is what makes it art.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like the CCA agency was looking for a workman to create a duplicate of what they considered either a historical artifact or a decorative piece. And that's not what they got. Your carver treated it like a piece of art and like a piece of cultural work.
Right.
Little disconnect there.
Right. Artistic license in the presentation doesn't necessarily change the framework of the story it's trying to tell. Yeah, the symbology is still the same. But, anyway, yeah.
No, that's a really interesting story, and I think that's a good example of that sort of thing. Art is looked at differently in different cultures, and this was actually kind of a conversation I was having with someone a few weeks ago at the Sheldon Museum about how it's for most non-native North Americans, art is decorative, either that or it's journalism. You know, there's a picture of something because you're trying to show something, or it's decorative. You enjoy it. You've got it in your house. You've got it out on your courthouse lawn or something. But it's a decoration. It doesn't necessarily tell a story. Whereas, in a lot of the native traditions, there are. I don't want to use the word constraints, but there's a context for it. And it serves another purpose. And I think that I don't want to be speaking for a culture of which I am not, but I think that there's simply a disconnect between cultures in what these pieces are and how they function and what the artist's role is.
I think the CCC, the CCP's, or the CC... Oh, no, it's not CCP, the Conservation Corps. Their interpretation was it's an artifact. We want that same one.
Right.
You know. And it was under their opinion that the native cultures were either dead or dying. Mm-hmm. I think the carver of the Howcan Eagle... carve something new, because in his mind the culture is alive.
Yeah, I think you're right about them being seen as dead or dying. I think the word we might be looking for is that they were static.
Right.
Yeah, they were artifacts, that the cultures themselves were artifacts.
I think I remember seeing too a lot of the recarved totem poles. They all belong to different clans, different houses. So, and I think they actually had potlatches and kuiks, and killed money on a lot of them to make them official when they put them in these new parks. Mm-hmm. So, it was a kind of a continuation. It wasn't just a dead thing, you know, or a copy of something that was culturally significant. In their minds, they were still going about their day-to-day cultural lives. So, yeah, so living thing, yeah. Rather than just this contextless kind of archaic object or something like that. But, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the equivalent of like, oh, there's the Mona Lisa. I'd like a copy of that to put up on my wall.
Yeah, and you know, it kind of goes back, and it's funny that we would be talking about, you know, Thlinkit culture and its 10,000-year-old culture in the context of greater European art. I mean, you always hear about people vandalizing the old masterworks. Mm-hmm. There's this guy. Okay, and this is really going off on a limb here.
Go ahead.
There's,
go for it.
There's this guy that drinks food dye and then vomits on old masterworks from the Renaissance. Well, he sounds insane, but you listen to his reasoning, and it's something that, like, back in the early, late 1800s, like, when they had this kind of explosion of, like, Impressionism and Expressionism, mm-hmm. there was a feeling of a tyranny of the old, basically. You know, like the Mona Lisa. The Mona Lisa is never going to change, you know. Right. It's just, and it takes up so much attention and so much room in a gallery that could be displaying new things, new artists, people who are alive mm-hmm. and could use the support of the arts community. But instead, we've kind of, you know, it's stuck. You go in the museum, it's in the past, you know. These great masters kind of monopolize cultural consciousness and museum space. So, and you know, you don't, as opposed to Thlinkit culture, when new interpretations, new pieces were always being made all the time. If someone had a very important clan hat, at some point it would be retired. They wouldn't destroy it, but it would be maybe they'd bring it out sometimes, maybe, but it would be relegated to storage and a new piece would be carved, you know. There's a emphasis on reestablishing these kinds of relationships. And that was another thing too. It was a relationship in between that house and its opposites, or, you know, so it was something that needed to be revitalized. Now, yeah, so always it supported the new works from the new artists by design, as opposed to, you know, the Western. And you ask people about name five pieces of art, like the standard layman, they're probably going to name some old, you know, the Statue yeah. of David, the Mona Lisa, Rodin, you know, all these, mm-hmm. all the kind of things. Yeah, so almost as if those things had their time, you know, now it's time for something new, something that is from us who are here alive today mm-hmm. and see the world that we currently live in, rather than something from the past. Now, that is not to say that it's kind of like a contradiction, you know. Thlinkit art is very rigid sometimes. It's very emphasized that things must be done a certain way. But yeah, it's interesting. There's a quote from, I think, Bill Reed, who is a Haida artist. You're trying to, within this rigid framework full of responsibilities and obligations, you're trying to carve out your place of freedom within the confines of this world that you're born into, these structures and rules and obligations, almost crushing. You see people living forms and animals living in these squares and these boxes, almost being squeezed and twisted, almost confined, manipulated by this kind of space, this rigid structure that they're born into. But within that, they still have their freedom of expression while still meeting their obligations. Something like that. It was pretty good. I heard that probably a decade ago, and it stuck with me.
No, I get that, and I know that an artist, in whatever context, whatever medium, can have a lot of freedom, but there's a learning that comes before that, that, you know, you learn to use your tools, you learn the iconography of what it is that you're doing, you learn the preparation that comes beforehand. You know, if you're not a very good musician, I don't care if you're expressing yourself or not, I may not be really enjoying it, which means I won't be paying attention to it.
There's a fundamental rules for things. Now, it seems almost counterintuitive that something as formless and ruleless as music mm-hmm. would have a surprisingly very rigid structure with how it works. But it's always with the, you don't just break the rules, you break the rules beautifully.
Yes.
There's an intention. I mean, there's always an intention by that, but deeper harmonies, you know, and I think Clinkit Art had a lot of probably all of the kind of deeper geometries that were really discussed and nailed down. Not only in like around the year 1000 with kind of like the height of the Islamic civilization with all the discovery of geometry and geometric forms, but the Renaissance as well. It's funny, like the rediscovery of people like Plato and Socrates. They first heard of those texts through Arabic translations that were kept for centuries, you know.
We have no original texts of Plato and Socrates.
No, yeah. So all of those kind of deeper fundamental human mysteries in terms of art, I believe were studied. I always bring this up. I think Lance Twitchell was saying that he was trying to translate a geometry textbook, and they didn't have to invent any words to translate an entire geometry textbook. Clinkit already has, you know, circumference, diameter, radius. Mm-hmm. It actually has, I believe, like 5 or 6 different words for circumference that mean... They're deeper. They go into which axis, horizontal axis or vertical axis, circumferences. And if you look at the art, you know, it's obvious. They had a deep knowledge of, you know, kind of mathematical precision and all that kind of stuff. It was necessitated.
Right.
Almost necessitated. Kind of like I've heard some that Islamic art, because of the prohibition against representative forms,
right?
Like no birds, no animals, yeah. No people. It necessitated a study of deeper mathematics in order to make these beautiful tile mosaics. I've been talking too much.
No, you're. I think you're doing fine.
No, I'm enjoying it.
It's yes, it's turned into a free form conversation, but that's probably why we're here. Yeah. Ron, is there anything else you'd like to add? This sweet lady is sitting here just smiling at us as we talk.
You know, my year is just going to be, you know, all about learning cedar as much as possible in any way I can. Even though my mentor is, you know, way down at Craig and I'm up here, so it makes it more of a unique situation. Doing a lot of traveling back and forth. I'm just soaking up as much as I can and learning, you know, all different ways of weaving. And then I'm also just very excited to teach what I've learned to others.
That's always the next step in learning, isn't it?
Yes. So there'll be others that can do this too.
How much of the weaving style is traditional, or is a constraint? And how much of yourself do you get to put in it, just since this is what we've been talking about? Any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah. See, right now she's trying to teach me the Tlingit weave, right. Which is a little bit more difficult than the Haida. But the stuff that I make on the side is my input on it, like the tiny basket earrings, you know. I also made a graduation cap too, as well. I weaved one. I make just roses also at the live artists on the trail. I made a bunch of
Helen cedar roses. Oh, Helen was saying that you were making roses and giving them out.
And I was giving them out.
That's so cool.
That's
so cool.
Yeah. Just want to make it fun. So it's easy to learn.
Once you've got the technique, and then that's what you're jumping off of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you make a basket perfectly in the traditional way, but you make it small, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, these are much smaller.
But yeah.
All right. You know, Helen Alton had originally planned on joining us, but I think she's got a meeting or something, a teleconference right now. So I was hoping she'd be able to run in at the last minute, but I don't know if she'll be able to make it or not. So it's just us here. Anything? I mean, I'm really enjoying this talk about history and context. Zach, anything else you'd like to add here?
Oh, I don't know. I had some kind of thread, train of thought that was going on, and now I just totally lost it. I don't know.
Oh, come on. It's in there somewhere, man.
ask a question, and maybe I'll think of something. I'm not sure.
All right. The houseboat that you're building, how much of the traditional training that you've had goes into a structure like that that isn't traditional? Any thoughts on that?
Oh, it's traditional.
Yeah.
In terms of form, it's the purpose of it culturally that's non-traditional.
Right.
Though, in a way, it is. I think it is kind of traditional. I mean, all I'm trying to do is, you know, honor basically my other side, you know, my mother's father, that there is someone to accept that, but in terms of the carving of it, oh God, I got to use everything I've learned in terms of layout, carving technique, traditional. Traditional is an interesting word. It's kind of like I have this silver bracelet on right now. You go past before a certain point, before the introduction of silver, these bracelets didn't really exist.
Right.
However, they took these new ideas and then created a whole new kind of, and it's interesting too, because it has its own subset of rules apart from painted forms, which is interesting. Just within, you know, must have been 50 years, they invented this entire new, not only art form, but structures, conventions, you know. So new things, I think, were greatly appreciated. Anything that could save time, effort, you know. It was taken in and incorporated and kind of made Clanget, you know. Any kind of, it's like the whole steel thing, you know. Steel was pretty limited back in the day. There's some meteorite steel, and there's some old stories too of pieces of shipwrecks washing up on the beach, and then they would pull the nails out of it. Mm-hmm. But with the introduction of the introduction of, you know, cheap and plentiful steel, that kind of changed. They say that kind of changed things a lot. Really, it just made it a lot easier, a lot easier to do more. Maybe take things to another level. But, you know, in terms of techniques for carving, there can't be much different than how it was done before. I mean, mm-hmm. planar.
Right.
Planar reasoning. You break the big forms down into planes, mm-hmm. Which are more easily measurable. If you start making big curves, like you're carving clay, mm-hmm. or you're sculpting clay and trying to shaping it, it's going to be difficult. You're going to lose your bearings quickly. Mm-hmm. Now, in the Renaissance times, and there's a lot of debate on this too, and even in Roman, Greek times, they had this device called the pointing machine. Mm-hmm. And it was very scandalous at the time when they found some incomplete Roman Greco statues, mm-hmm. and you could see the marks where mm-hmm. they used a pointing machine. They thought that was
cheating.
Cheating, yes. They call it cheating.
Yeah,
but. You know, oh, maybe they weren't so as great as we thought
right,
they
yeah.
were. But there's that, you see that a lot, that if with these kind of like amorphous round forms, mm-hmm. you lose your bearings, the pointing machine comes out to kind of, and then you would measure off of a model, usually mm-hmm. scaled, you know. But in terms of Clanget carving, I only know from what I've seen. I'd love to see an incomplete Clanget mask from a long time ago. I don't think I have. But how I was taught from Wayne, and how Wayne learned from, you know, those old timers like Leo Jacobs and Ed Casco, it was planar, kind of a planar measurement. So I'm pretty sure. And mostly hand tools as well. We have a lot of these modern implements, like a power planer or a chainsaw. Electric chainsaw is nice. It doesn't mm-hmm. stink up the house. Mm-hmm. But they're fast, but they're too aggressive. There's a lot of risk involved every time you pull them out. And so most wood carvers I know... only use that for the most basic of roughing out, mm-hmm. Or very early in the process. I don't think, now that the rough of the face is out, I don't think I'll pull out a power tool again. If you have adz, I mean, adz is like it's so many things all in one, like a hammer and the mallet in one tool, mm-hmm. but, it's like a jackhammer with a razor blade on the end of it. And the level of precision you can have is comparable to anything else. So, you know, it's funny, we have all these modern implements, but I think the adz maintains its value as a tool. I mean, I'm not a I take the easy way.
Uh-huh. You're not a Luddite?
No. I'll take the easiest way to achieve whatever it is that I think is my vision for what this wants to look like. But funny enough, my hand keeps reaching for the ads over and over again. And I don't think that's... it can't be pride. It can't be some kind of cultural feeling. It's just the best.
Yeah, well, you know, a tool by definition is something that takes the energy of your hands and multiplies it and makes the job easier. So if it's doing the job, then it's the right tool. If it's not doing exactly what you need it to do, then it's not the right tool for exactly what you're doing.
It's funny that, you know, a stick and a piece of wood can still hold its own against all these modern implements. I mean, and we live in the age of, you know, AI-produced art and things like that, where the tools are almost dehumanizing, really. I think there's something to be said for the capabilities of human beings against, you know, this kind of enormous, soulless kind of machine that we find ourselves participating in. I think it's difficult to beat, and I think especially for, you know, when we're trying to express what it means to be a human, I don't think you can throw a bunch of garbage on the wall 1,000 times and then randomly you'll find something that's incredibly compelling. You can. You make something good, but the act of the human mind,
judgment.
Reacting kind of. Everything you've seen, everything you've felt, everything you've experienced, everything you've heard, everything you've been told, you know, everything you've loved and hated kind of goes into your judgment and reasoning of something you make. And I don't think a machine has that. But this is a very... So I got the stick and the metal. I think it's good.
Yeah.
it is both powerful and precise. And in my hand, it feels nice.
Yeah, and that goes back down to judgment. That's what machines don't have. And there's good science fiction, you know, conversations to be had here about whether the androids will ever be able to have feelings, and those conversations are great, but they belong in a different place. I think right now, I think if you're going to take one word, what makes us human in this context, I think it's judgment, because we have this endless reserve of those experiences and those preferences and things that have affected us, that whenever every single decision you make, it's your entire mind is making that decision. So when you go for the ads versus the power tool, there's a lot that's going into that decision.
First and foremost, I want to make the best thing.
Right.
It helps me achieve that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's a judgment that you've made is which tool is actually going to let you do what you are actually trying to do.
Yeah, it's so pleasant to work with too. I mean, I wonder though if the impacts are a little hard on the joints, but Wayne still seems to be at it, so I think it's not too bad. I mean, hopefully I don't get arthritis or something, but I mean, that's why you can still paint, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the machine can help me out a little bit, steady my brush, but yeah, that's the other thing. Everybody's really, if there's one tool, modern tool, that people are really jumping on, especially Northwest Coast artists, graphic design programs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Procreate. Everybody uses Procreate. It's crazy. But it helps with a lot of things. Reproduction, mm-hmm. making perfect reproductions of things and things like that. But yeah, I think a little brush stabilization. I mean, it's still there's a human intention behind it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it's just... You know, and then you can tell when you're fighting it, and it's like, why don't you do what I want? Mm-hmm. That's the kind of the mindlessness of the machine versus actual human intention. Mm-hmm. But hey, now I've really gotten off topic.
No, it's all art, man. It's all part of the topic.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you could justify talking about pretty much anything.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and that's what I'm doing. I'm justifying it.
Yeah, okay.
We are totally on topic.
I believe you.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming in. Here again, this Rhonda is sitting here sweetly smiling at us, and she's being so patient.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, I want you know, thanks for coming in. Thanks for showing me your tiny little earrings. They're really very sweet, and the tiny little pieces of. Do you call it something besides bark once you prepare it for weaving? I mean, I know it's bark, but Do the pieces now have a word now that they've become a...
No.
I would just say...
Cedar weaving.
Just cedar. Just hand me that bark over there, even though it's tiny little...
There's the warps, and then there's the weavers.
The weave, okay.
Yeah, the yellow
and
the red cedar.
You use the different cedars for... different purposes, like one is the warp and one is the weave?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I get them from my mentor down in Craig. I thin it. The longest part of it all is the preparation.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah. Thinning it down.
Yeah, because some of those pieces are just, measured in millimeters. They're so tiny.
The tiny earrings is like I'm taking an extra step in thinning it down.
Right. How long are the pieces when you're working with them? How long can they be?
Like the tiny earrings, I was actually measuring it last night because I'm finishing an order. The weaver is like 2 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It doesn't take much materials.
All right. All right. Well, that just about wraps up our hour here. Thank you, Zach, for coming in.
No problem.
This is the kind of conversation that is normally done in front of a beer, but I think this was really interesting.
You might hit on a little couple nuggets of gold here and there, but you know, you never know what you'll find.
No, you never know what you'll find. All right. Okay, well, Rhonda Degtoff is our weaver, and Zach James is our carver, and I want to thank them both for being here. And all right, well, thank you both. Have a great day. You're listening to KHNS. This has been Art Matters. My name is Angie. This is a program that we do occasionally. And maybe we'll do it a little bit more. I'm gonna put a piece of music out so we can all make a bunch of noise while we hoof it out of here. And thank you all for listening. Here we go.